Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Once again, gird your loins. Sit down, pour yourself a drink, unless you're driving. The Chicago Way. Radio Free Chicago in podcast form. Jeff Carlin and John Cass. Hello, Jeff Carlin.
Good morning.
Jeff, a lot is going on. I hear also that you've baked a scrumptious peach pie.
Yes, for Father's Day. I made my dad his favorite, which I'd never made before, which was a peach pie. But I used a new recipe this time. Normally, one for the traditional, like the lattice crust, or maybe a full crust, if depending on your pie preferences. But I saw an interesting take. In fact, fun fact: I saw this on one of the Tribune posters that was up on the wall, the big blown up posters at Litfest where you were talking. And they had it on the wall, and I was like, "Try this new way of doing crusts." And it's an interesting way, but it's really. It's a Russian-style crust topping. It's
collusion?
Collusion. Where you freeze the dough, and then you grate it over the top of the filling once it's set in the pie. And so instead of having a pressed dough crust, you have this different kind of flaky, crumbly topping.
What about the sides of the pie?
Well, normal liner for it. I mean, this recipe said you could do it with, do a bottom crust like that and kind of lay it out, but that wasn't my thing. So I made my traditional bottom crust, but then I shredded a crust on top, and it was
interesting.
It worked out quite well.
Frozen Russian crust pie.
Yeah.
Interesting. I've got a food thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
4th of July is coming, and you know that the Greeks gave us democracy.
Yeah.
So instead of doing a yee-haw country rib, like sweet, finger-licking good candy syrupy sauce for your ribs, I thought, how about, pardon me, instead of doing all that for your ribs and making them candy, how about doing them Greek style? Press about five or six. Let's say you have two ribs. Press them out five or six cloves of garlic. The zest of a lemon. Lemon juice, no seed. Olive oil. Fresh ground black pepper. And by fresh ground, it doesn't mean from a can. It means grinding it.
Sure.
Because it's 100% different.
Oh, yeah.
Salt, kosher salt, and oregano.
Did you ever use any white pepper for that?
White pepper could be good, too.
I like white pepper.
And then make a paste. Put that over your ribs that you've already brined or at least rinsed and set in vinegar until they're, for an hour or two. And then put those on the top rack of your smoker. Underneath, a steel non-reactive pan full of potatoes with salt, pepper, a little butter, a little olive oil, similar seasonings, and make some roast Greek potatoes. They cook under the two ribs that are dripping their essence and spices and juices mm-hmm. on top of those potatoes on the lower rack. And there you go, 4th of bleeping July.
Sounds good to me. For Father's Day, my brother and I cooked lunch for my dad at my brother's house. And we did two T-bone steaks for my dad, my brother, and I cooked a fish fillet on the grill, nice salmon fillet. And I did potatoes and the pie. And the potatoes were my dad loved. But my recipe for potatoes is I brine. Usually I use either new potatoes, or this time I use a mix of red potatoes I halved or quartered it down to make them about the same size as my new potatoes, so they're all cooked
right,
at the same time.
So they cook the same.
Yeah, and but before I do that, I poke holes in them, and I take a fork and I sit there, and it takes like a half hour to, you know, stab all these potatoes. But I put about 4 or 5 punctures almost all the way through, not to the center.
Even the ones that you've cut in half.
Well, I don't cut them in half yet. So this is before. I cut them in half before I cook them. But so they're whole potatoes, stab them, and then I set them in like a solution of water and seasoning salt in a pot, and I cover it, and I, you know, put about half a cup or to a quarter cup, depending on how many potatoes I have, of seasoning salt and water. Throw in a little bit of baking soda, just a touch, just because it helps break down the skin a little bit.
Uh-huh.
It releases some of the pectin. Learn that from Cook's Country.
Uh-huh.
Ding.
Interesting.
And then brine that for as long as I can. Usually try to do 8 hours minimum on
it. So overnight in the fridge.
Yeah, overnight in the fridge. And then pull them out, lay them on a sheet to dry. They kind of get a little crystalline crust to them of sorts. And then I have the bigger ones or quarter them down if they need to be. And I, while they're drying, I make an emulsion. Usually use a little fresh rosemary and thyme. So I add a little bit of lemon juice to that and some garlic and olive oil. And I, you know, emulsify it in my food processor. And then I toss them all in that. Let that drip off the pan so it collects back at the bottom. You know, take the excess, put it aside. And then I put a line of foil pan, put my potatoes down. If they're cut potatoes, put them, you know, the flesh side down. And so they're all, you know, they've all been now touched with all this, the marinade of sorts. And then I drip it over the top, you know, 350, 40 minutes, pull them out, let them cool a little bit, and they are delicious. They have a nice crispiness on the outside, and they're like almost whipped potatoes on the inside. They're so soft on the inside.
That sounds, you know, so forth. And cob corn?
Yeah, we would do that, but...
But I mean, for 4th of July, would you add that?
Absolutely.
What else would you do for 4th of July? It's coming up. People got to know.
Yeah, I mean, the ribs sound great. That sounds like a great...
Ribs are good anyway. Beer can chicken is good. You can find these all in the... Oh, the Weber guy. Some Weber... I was talking about some recipes doing on the Weber, and Weber Grill started retweeting.
Yeah?
The stuff.
How many Webers do you own, John?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Six
is that
Webers.
Enough?
I think you should be
three
good.
Three kettles, 2 Weber Smoky Mountain cookers, and a Genesis.
Nice.
Is that enough? I don't think so. Nothing exceeds like excess, correct?
Right.
Okay, so chicken, you know how to do that. Ribs, you know how to do that. Now, everybody, you know Jeff's potatoes. You got my potatoes. What's a good side? What are good sides for 4th of July?
Yeah.
People have to make it, you know. Do something good. Like, all right, you can do the – people like their corn boiled.
Yeah,
they always say grill mine, but then they really don't like it grilled.
I like it grilled. I prefer – and people don't – I mean, the trick to good grilled corn
– Parboiling.
Well, not even that. You leave it – you soak it in water, just straight water with husks. Just dump – you know, if you're going to do –
a cup of sugar.
You do a cup of sugar helps,
yeah. Cheap. That's cheap.
That's cheap, but – and you just soak them overnight. You know, maybe it doesn't have to be overnight, but you could do at least an hour. You know, before you put them on.
Put them in a bucket with a brick on top.
Yeah, and you just let them sit, and then you take them with the husks. You leave the husk on, and you throw them on the grill. And you don't put them over direct heat. You put them to the side, or maybe up off of the indirect heat. Let those things go for an hour while you're cooking everything else, and then when you pull it off, that corn will be steamed and delicious. Oh, it's so good. A little salt and butter on that.
How's this? You take the husk, soak it, take the husks off, clean it, put it on the grill just enough to get a little brown color. Not a lot. I'm talking about a few minutes, okay? A couple minutes, 3 minutes. Put them in an aluminum pan with butter, basil, parsley, salt, pepper, and what am I missing? No, that's about it. And then shake them up in that pan. Seal it tight with aluminum foil and put it on the, put it indirect for about 20 minutes.
That's delicious.
You know? But people overdo when they grill corn,
mm-hmm.
They leave it on too long and then it gets chewy and people don't like that.
Yeah.
You know? And also drinks. What's Jeff going to have for, like, what's your favorite summer drink?
My favorite summer drink is Irish cider over ice. So like a Magners over ice. That's
really?
Good. Oh, yeah.
I got to try that.
That's very good on a warm day.
See, I would go British. Gin and tonic with bitters.
There you
go. And lime. But that's me.
Or a slice of cucumber in there.
In the gin?
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah, cucumber and gin is great.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You can make like a cucumber syrup. You know, you take a cucumber and blend it up with just a little sugar. And then you boil it down so it gets a little thicker until you have a syrup. And you do that. Add that to a gin and tonic. That'll be the best gin and tonic you ever had.
You take the seeds out first?
No, if you blend it, you'll blend the crap out of it. So it won't, I mean, you're pulverizing really? It. It won't matter.
I'm going to have to try that, Jeff Carlin.
I would skin, though.
Skin the cucumber.
Yeah, I mean, peel it because it's tougher. I mean, you do a little bit of the flavor, but if you are gonna leave the skins on, you can just. I would dice it up so you get everything blended down pretty evenly.
Well, that's what I'm gonna do. You know, make the gin and tonic and get ready for this governor's race that's coming up. I mean, it's pretty interesting. I just think it's a J.B. Pritzker show right now. You know, and the question for everyone running for governor. On the Democratic side, why would you want to run for governor if Mike Madigan is the boss of Illinois? If you're a Democrat, why do you want to be a footman? You were going to spend millions of dollars so you could be a butler, call yourself Jeeves, and run when he snaps his fingers? I don't know. By thy rivers gently flowing, Illinois, Illinois, o'er thy prairies verdant growing, Illinois, Illinois, comes an echo on the breeze, rustling through the leafy trees. Boss Madigan has us on our knees, Illinois, Illinois. Boss Madigan has us on our knees, Illinois. All right, it's not the greatest song, but we have a great candidate, or an interesting one, one who I disagree with. But what can I say? I like progressives for lunch and dinner, and also sitting here at the Chicago Way. Here we are with Amaya Pawar, alderman of the 47th Ward, candidate for governor, and exhibit 15 in the evidence that Cass does talk to progressives and cares about what they have to say. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So you're running for governor.
I am.
Don't you have enough on your plate dealing with Rahm? You would abandon us and let Rahm run rampant and now run for governor? Why is this?
You know, I've been traveling the state for 6 months at this point, and everywhere I go, I hear the same thing, which is people are sick and tired of fighting over scraps. You know, one of the things I said at pre-slating, or what I say on the stump, is I'm tired of watching Governor Rauner go to majority poor white communities and tell them that they don't get their fair share for schools or economic development because Chicago or Cook County does, and those people get theirs. And I feel like that preys on people's economic anxieties and fears when the truth is downstate communities in Chicago, Rockford, Cairo, Carbondale, they've all been left behind because of automation or deindustrialization. I've seen it in my own family. See, my dad's an engineer. He's an immigrant. My parents are immigrants from India. And growing up, I can't tell you how many times he was laid off. You know, he'd work a year, be laid off for two, work two, be laid off for one because of automation or trade deals. And so while we did okay, there are a lot of people around this country, and especially in Illinois and the Midwest, that have been left behind because they had good jobs. They were able to get ahead. Now they don't have good jobs. They're barely making more than minimum wage, and no one is talking about the communities that have been left behind.
I wasn't going to start this way.
Yeah.
Because I've watched you work in the city council and that you stand up for things that I think are important. Even though I disagree with you politically, mm-hmm. However, I noticed this great technique, which I've seen only in 5,000 years of covering politics, mm-hmm. where you throw a race card at someone, and then pivot quietly into class issues or other issues. Mm-hmm. And I sincerely want to tell you this respectfully, mm-hmm. that I find that to be not worthy of your intellect or of anyone's intellect. Are there regional and class and other differences between Illinois, Southern Illinois, mm-hmm. and Cook County? Yes. Does Cook County dominate Illinois with the boss Madigan? You can lose almost all the counties in the state, and if you get Cook County, you win an election. All that stuff goes into what you're saying that you didn't mention. And I find that the use of the race card is...
I hear you.
Sad.
No. And as someone...
I hate to use sad because Trump uses sad, but it saddens me. As the son of an immigrant myself,
yeah.
right? And I know you're the son of an immigrant.
It's not something that I talk about or use lightly. It's not as if I'm doing
this. No, you use it politically. You stood in front of the pre-slating with all these Democratic committeemen who use whatever hammers and scythes or whatever they use, whatever tools they use to chop down and to build up, and you played it.
So it starts with two real issues. I mean, I can go on there's a whole litany of them. When you go around the state and you say Chicago public schools are prisons, and you say the Chicago public schools teachers are virtually illiterate, what does that tell you? When you have a policy that says after the Paris terror attacks, to say be one of the few governors that are far out there on the right that say, let's ban Syrian refugees. Or if you have an agenda that is saying, I want redistricting reform. I want to make sure we have competitive elections because that's reform. And in many ways, I believe in redistricting reform. But then at the same time say, I will not sign automatic voter registration because there's voter fraud. And, you know, most Republicans don't even talk about voter fraud. It's on the far right, the far, far right.
In other words, if you talk about it, you're on the far, far right and therefore to be shamed.
Well,
you see, I understand the rhetorical games because I've engaged them in myself mm-hmm. and I see them.
But,
and I would much rather not joust with you on stuff, on ground that I've gone over with others many, many times. I'm just trying to offer the argument that I see you, as I wrote in the column last week, that I see you as, if not running, you're running for governor now, clearly, but you're also putting the Pawar flag throughout the state and raising your profile. And I see you as possibly running for mayor someday or some other office like that. How do you, what do you think?
I have a 16-month-old daughter, and I got married 2 years ago. The amount of time that this is taken away from spending time with her, she's only going to be a baby once. And in a few years from now, she won't want anything to do with me. My point is...
She will.
I hope so. My point is, I'm not trying to hopscotch around. You know, I term limited myself.
I know.
And so...
It's rather disconcerting to many of your constituents, I'd say.
I think...
You have, like, this whole Pawar thing going on in your neighborhood, right?
I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to hopscotch around. One of the reasons why I ran is, look, I didn't say this at the pre-slating. So if you give me a second to tell you about why I could talk about divide and rule and this race stuff. So my parents are from India.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use divide and rule from a personal perspective. So my dad was born in India under British rule. He was mm-hmm. 5 years old when India gained independence.
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy that I use is, think about the way the Indians were ruled by the British. See, the British were few, and they were very wealthy. And they
kind of like Madigan and J.B. Pritzker, you mean?
And
like it. Is that how you're doing?
You can
going?
Add Bruce Rauner.
I'll play it. Yeah, go on.
And the way the British ruled over the Indians was they divided them up based on where they lived, based on who they worshipped, based on the job they did, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Right?
This is how conquerors divide
countries
so that they conquer.
And they keep people who are natural allies fighting one another over scraps.
Okay. So
how is that any different?
So how are the evil Republicans doing this to the good people of Illinois?
I don't believe Republicans are evil.
All right. Well, how are the pre-Mountbatten Republicans doing this?
I think it's really just the matter of the oligarchs. It's not Republicans. If you talk to Leader Durkin or Rodonio, they'll tell you that they want to deal as much as the Democrats do. They might differ on specific policy ends. But, I mean, look at Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill.
Yeah.
I mean, they were able to get things together. I don't think they really liked each other, but they would cut a deal, have a drink, go back to battling each other the next day,
right,
and get to a deal. We've gotten to a place in this country where everything that government does is looked from a negative perspective, right? So Speaker Boehner comes along at the congressional level because Grover Norquist says, let's get rid of earmarks. So now there's no incentive for Democrats and Republicans to say, let's take tough votes for one another, but I'm going to be able to bring home something to my district, whether it's a clinic, a new ball field, bring back investment. There's no incentive. So everything is evil. Everything is negative.
Well, I would suggest, I would love to take your course in political philosophy when I have time. But I would suggest that kind of trading, mm-hmm, and horse trading, it runs counter to the whole idea of why you elect somebody. I mean, let's just get back to people are being taxed. They don't think they're getting what they're spending on. The Democrats are coming up with another tax issue, and then they're not coming up with any kind of meaningful structural reform. In Illinois, how do you see that? Do you see it that way?
I think the one thing Bruce Rauner is right about is the only way out of this long term is growth. But I look at it a different kind of growth, population growth. We need young people to start moving here and staying here. So I look at what's actually happening. So people are losing their jobs to machines. Automation is running rampant in our economy. So how are we going to make sure that young people can come here and stay here over the long term if jobs and the economy are changing?
Not more Starbucks.
No. But it's coming to fields like trucking. You know, that's the job that most people list as what they do for what they do for a living, whether it's driving a truck or driving a taxi or a cargo truck. These jobs are going to be automated in 6 years or less, right?
Which is why progressives are suggesting that there'd be an expanded welfare state so we could sit here on our ass and drink beer and watch TV.
That's not what I'm suggesting.
Right. I'm just telling you what you know that's out there. So what do you think?
If you drive around the state, and this is why I've spent a majority of my time in central and southern Illinois, communities have been left behind. They haven't seen any major investment. I was in Jasper County 3 months ago, and we're driving through town, and our guide says, look, that 3-block-long factory used to employ 1,000 people 25 years ago. There are 50 there today. And I asked what happened, and they said NAFTA, right? But then we went and talked to the farmers in the area, corn and soy.
Brazil. Farmer.
They love it because they say they have expanded market access. But one thing that we heard over and over again, this is what we hear all over the state, is that when the jobs were leaving, politicians from both sides of the aisle said, don't worry, we're going to make investments. We're going to make sure you have jobs. Fast forward 20 years, where do you think their temperature is? They're here, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how we get to Trump, because you run into the arms.
Well, I would disagree, but go on.
My broader point here is there is a massive change coming to our economy with automation. People are going to lose their jobs to machines. Telling a 50-year-old trucker who makes a solid wage to go to community college after he or she loses their job to a machine, to then maybe have a job at the other side of it, is a non-starter. And that's why I keep talking about our campaign from a New Deal perspective. There needs to be a bridge between the jobs that are leaving today to the jobs of tomorrow. And that is through infrastructure. Because we've
You mean like federal? You want the federal government?
No,
to
the
build?
State.
So you're going to raise taxes then? You want to raise taxes?
I believe in a progressive income tax.
Okay, and do you believe in a concomitant cut in the property taxes?
Yeah, I think we're overly reliant on property taxes.
Yes, I agree there. I agree. One of the things I'm going to ask all the candidates for governor, Democrats, and I want them all on, mm-hmm. and I hope I can see each other again. I'd very much like to.
Yeah, of course.
Not even here, but I mean, just grab lunch and talk.
Of course.
And watch you campaign. Is the issue of Madigan?
Yeah.
I've noticed how several of them are playing it. Biz is playing it one way. JB Pritzker pretends, oh, there's no Madigan. Don't bring up Madigan or I won't pay for this party. And others play it. Kennedy plays it sort of in a passive aggressive way, going right up to it, not saying his name. My question is, why, if you know that Madigan's the boss, controls the legislature, basically the de facto, he is not the de facto, he is the boss of the state of Illinois. As a Democrat, why would you want to be governor? You saw what happened to Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
Blagojevich, separate the, prison term, mm-hmm. just the disaster that he had in dealing with Madigan elsewhere. Why do it, knowing that Madigan's the boss? Like I said, it's like the son-in-law, the groom buying the wedding and then going into the family business, and
so he's
just the son-in-law.
You may not agree with my politics, but my view on this is we have a once, seriously, in a generation opportunity because Speaker Madigan over the last 2 years has moved dramatically to the left, which is where I sit in space.
I understand. I respect that.
And so I don't really care if he did it for self-preservation or if he did it because he believes in it or some combination of the two. If there's a governor who's a Democrat who believes in those same things that he's moved left on, then we hold him accountable to it. And I'm going to move on it.
I don't understand. What does that mean?
Meaning,
my question is, why run for governor as a Democrat knowing that Madigan – mm-hmm. is the boss. So you are basically the servant of Madigan. And that's the question. I appreciate the rhetorical abilities of switching my question, but that's the one I want to answer.
Because I don't, even in city council, I've had people like Alderman Burke work against me on issues that I cared about, like the Independent Budget Office
right. Or
the Inspector General reform. But I've never made it about Ed Burke when we were going toe-to-toe. I was willing to say, okay, you're going to disagree with me on something, so I'm going to work really hard against you by trying to line up votes on the other side. Because if I make it about you and about personalities, I can't win that because I'm just a Maya Pawar. I didn't come from money. I did this on my own. I have no political backer saying, we're going to hold you up no matter what you say or do. So my job is to stitch together coalitions on my side of the issue. And so I'm not really interested in going toe-to-toe on personalities.
I didn't ask you to.
No, what I'm saying
is, the question is, why run for governor as a Democrat knowing that Mike Madigan is the true boss of things?
Yeah.
Not the governor.
Well, I think,
if you're a Democrat.
If I'm elected governor, I'm not worried about Michael Madigan. I have an agenda that I want to move on.
And what would that be?
I believe that the entire state deserves a new deal around public schools, child care, jobs, and criminal justice reform. I think that working families, it seems that no matter what they do or how hard they work, whether they live in Chicago or downstate, are having a tough go at things. And so there needs to be a change in the way government operates, and more importantly, there needs to be a change in the way we serve our people. And it can't be starving public institutions, starving public schools, our universities, and then say that's the best way to serve working people.
Our universities, I agree with a lot. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't know if our universities are they starving?
I mean, SIU, Carbondale, Chicago State, NEIU, they don't know what they're going to do in the fall. So I keep hearing about Governor Rauner saying he wants to consolidate programs, cut waste, and all these other things. But, this guy went to Harvard and Dartmouth. He wants to consolidate political science and other programs from one university to the next. He never had to make those decisions But kids who go to state schools now somehow have to, you know, go to SIU for one subject and Eastern for another. The whole point of the higher ed experience is that everyone has diversity in the curriculum. It, all of everything.
We do. The one argument is that it's so expensive because we subsidize it. Why are the tuitions going up and up and up and up? The average person who's not in the progressive sphere, mm-hmm. who's not going to get a benefit from the government, can hardly afford it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to pay for your own car. I know, as a dad.
I know that because I've got $250,000 in loans.
Oh, God. Where did you go to school?
Missouri Valley for undergrad. And then
Jerry Rice, right? Jerry Rice, right?
No, he didn't go there.
No? Oh, Mississippi Valley State. Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
And okay. then the University of Chicago for graduate school.
And what did you major in?
So undergrad is in religion and philosophy, and then I've got three master's degrees. So public administration, social work, and then threat and response management.
Threat response management.
Mm-hmm.
Did you use that often when you were at city council and you first saw Rahm?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm a trained emergency manager. I mean, right. That's my job.
So how do you see Rahm Emanuel? Where do you see him going? It doesn't bother me, but it's quite interesting that a fellow who can be so weakened politically has no real opposition. Why is that?
I think it comes down to money. I think all of this, running for office, has come down to who has the most money. And then whoever has the most money can fashion the image they want to create about themselves.
But we have the trial of Laquan McDonald trial.
Yeah.
Poor kid is dead, but the cops trial, Van Dyke's trial, comes up. And then all that gets brought up again.
Mm-hmm.
His response to it, how it was handled, the secret, you know, sitting on the video and all that. I'm amazed to see that there. I see Rahm getting endorsements from some aldermen, and then those aldermen getting their whatever neighborhood mm-hmm. equities that they want handled through the budget. I don't see anyone. Maybe he's doing such a great job that no one thinks they have to challenge him.
I don't know about that. I think he's got two big issues he's got to resolve if he wants to run and win. One, what is he going to do about police accountability? Two, I think airport workers is the second big issue. We can't say we're immigrant friendly. We're friendly to refugees. We can't say we believe in making sure that everyone has access to the American dream. And then have 8,000 people work at our airports, many of whom don't even make minimum wage. You know, the people who push the wheelchairs and help you around the airport. I mean, they're on tips. And so we've let the airlines hire these contractors who treat our refugee and immigrant community members like dirt.
The employees. The employees. That's what you're saying.
And we need to take care of them. And so I think there are two big issues that Rahm needs to deal with. One, police accountability and police reform. And two, helping these working folks at the airport.
Where are the progressives on the police accountability issue where he blows off basically the consent decree?
That's, you know, the thing. I think the progressives
are where are they?
They're all in alignment. It's unbelievable to think. It's unbelievable to think that we would walk away from federal court oversight. Because the thing about oversight through a judge is this. It gets away from the politics, because if the federal monitor says you need to do A, B, and C, and the mayor, whoever the mayor is, says, you know what, I don't want to do that, a judge can then enforce that. That's the point of having federal oversight, is that it takes the politics out of it, the day-to-day issues out of it, and it makes it about the structural reform.
But he's been able to walk away with it without any cost.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of people speaking out about it. I am. The Progressive Caucus, Lisa Madigan, Tony Preckwinkle, Chuy Garcia.
Is it sticking?
It should start sticking. I mean, this is offensive.
in the last 10 years, the city's lost 100 more thousand middle-class African-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We have not increased the number of Latino immigrants, mm-hmm. right? You can see the numbers. The city shrinking, the state shrinking. All that does help REM, doesn't it?
No, I think cities...
Because middle-class people vote. The poor, I understand progressive politicians love this idea of we will organize the poor. But the fact remains, based on my experience, limited though it may be, that middle-class people vote. Poor people don't generally vote as much in those numbers. And when you have middle-class African-Americans leaving in those numbers, that tells me whoever's in power right now gets a free ride, or at least something of a free ride.
Well, I think what undergirds what you just said is what's happening to every major city around the world. Cities are gentrifying, and everyone else is getting pushed out. Cities around public transit, around the museums. Yeah, right. Exactly. London, Paris, New York,
right.
Chicago, Portland, Seattle, it's all the same. They're not places where it's harder and harder for middle-class families to survive in a major city. I mean, look, in San Francisco, $100,000 a year in income is now considered low income. So you can see what's
right.
happening.
It's
gentrification, but it's pushing everyone to the outskirts.
When does that hit a breaking point?
I mean,
we saw one with Trump's election, which was somewhat of a harbinger there. I mean, a reaction to the status quo, and I'm wondering if it will just keep getting more and more of these waves and shock waves back.
But that's the thing. If you have a rebalancing in the economy, so you I know we started at the beginning and said you didn't like the race piece.
It's not that I don't like the race piece. I think I understand why it's used.
Yeah.
I just think that it's not worthy of you.
So I hear you. What I try to use it is to show an example of what happens when people see each other as the other. When people are suffering, I don't believe people are racist. I don't think most people are racist. I think people start looking at one another as the other when they themselves feel like they can't get ahead. And then someone says, you know what? It's not your fault. It's their fault. And my point here—
You mean like check your privilege, Cass? Like people tell me to check my privilege, though what? My parents were born in a poor village on a mountain plateau and we had a mule for the wall.
Well, I'm not telling you to check anything.
No, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what you mean?
No, I'm not telling you to check yours.
Okay. I know you're not.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
saying rhetorically,
yeah.
right, when that's used.
What I'm saying is this class stuff
yeah.
comes up when a vast majority of people feel like they can't get ahead. And the only way to get out of it is not to add gas to the to the fire. It's to say, this is what's happening, guys, but we're more alike than we are different. So when I go downstate and I use that line about majority poor white communities, what I tell them is, look, it's not your fault. You haven't seen the investment just like other communities haven't. We have a lot more in common than you do apart. And I know that when I show up, they see Chicago Alderman, which is a pejorative even in Chicago sometimes. They see that I have a different name or I look different or whatever. And then we have this conversation. And I say, I hear you that your factory was automated or that you lost your job or that you used to make $20 an hour and you make $10 now. I've seen this in my own family. And then it's hard to hate someone or be mad at someone when you've had this conversation.
Well, I don't hate anyone. I love everyone, even progressives.
But
I would suggest, however, that this whole Mark... centrally managed economic plan that mm-hmm. you have has been, with respect, mm-hmm. has not had a great deal of success over in history. And that my own personal view, antiquated though it may be, is I like more free market. I want lower taxes. I want lower taxes to drive and bring investment here. The one thing about Indians and Greeks that we have in common is, of many things we have in common,
mm-hmm.
is that we all know about or in our family stories, we know what Indian daycare is and we know what Greek daycare is.
Yeah.
And that's when you go to work when you're like six and you're with your folks. You know what I mean? If they have a, if your father was a professional man, clearly not, but if they're the shopkeepers or business people, mm-hmm. you're the six, right? You have cousins. We all have cousins.
And I grew up with a lot of Greeks, so I know.
So you know the same.
Yeah.
And that, and they have to pay off the politician, and they have to pay the, they have to deal with someone who will be the middleman that goes to the government to take care of guys so that you can do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
All that is why, interestingly enough, I've probably become conservative because I grew up watching it.
Yeah.
And I think it's counterproductive to putting people to work. Low, smaller government, lower taxes, and with our transportation and central location, we should be doing a lot better than we're doing.
So I don't, I'm not for just big government for the sake of big government.
I didn't say you were.
No, no, but what I do believe is that what working families need is stability, that their schools are not going to close 6 months into the year. You know, those sorts of this, I believe in public institutions because I think those are the kinds of the, parks, schools, libraries, investing in infrastructure. These are the building blocks of a community. And if you do those things right, then businesses will flourish. I'll tell you, even in Chicago, at an event last night, and I try to tell people to start rethinking the way they view our neighbors. Because the question I get when I go to events is, so what's it like downstate? How do people receive you? And my first response is, why are you looking at downstate? Why are we there? It's not some exotic foreign land. Those are your neighbors.
Yeah.
It's just a couple hours away. And it's the same thing when I go downstate. It's like, well, why do you guys look at us downstate in the way you do? And so I feel like part of my job in this campaign is to try to be that bridge and say, we're not that different. We might have some different views on a few issues here and there. But I use this example a lot. LaSalle Street and the commodities that get traded there. None of that exists without our farms and our agrarian economy. We're dependent on one another. So I am sick and tired of letting people tell us we're different and use these racial, class, geographical divides to pit us against one another. That is why I'm running.
Mr. Pawar, I don't think your political futures are coming to an end. And whether you succeed in this gubernatorial race or not, I see you running for stuff in the future and being involved in public service. I know you have a child, and as a father, I can tell you sometimes the last thing you want to do is be away from them. But I do see something here. Unless, of course, you're just going to go and become a venture capitalist, which I doubt.
I don't think a social work degree qualifies me for finance.
Thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Well, it's been great learning about cucumber syrup for my gin and tonic, being lectured to by Amaya Pawar, an interesting progressive candidate for governor, and hearing all about Jeff Carlin's peach pie. Get ready for your ribs. Look in the paper for the rib recipe, for Jeff Carlin's recipe. I'll do a column on all that pre-4th of July so you can get ready. And in the meantime, for Amaya Pawar, alderman of the 47th Ward, candidate for governor, for Jeff Carlin, my buddy, and J.P. Carlin on Twitter, and me, your mild-mannered, nationally syndicated conservative columnist, from the Chicago Tribune, John Cass. Thanks, everybody. And remember this, the Chicago way is not a dream. It's a reality, and it's right in front of you. Take a walk on it.